7 Palestinians, a third of the scores killed, were children. For those attending the demonstration opposite Downing Street, the official residence of the British Prime Minister, they needed to be present to raise their voice against the injustice.
What we've witnessed over the last few days is very familiar, but no less horrific. Once again, Israel has been bombing the Palestinian people in Gaza, claiming a right to self-defense. There's a reality here that any form of violence that is used to enforce occupation, used to enforce apartheid, used to enforce settler colonialism is by definition illegitimate. It is the Palestinian people who have a right to defence and to protect themselves.
One of the main themes linking the speakers at this event is the fact that the Israeli aggression is only made possible by the tacit support of states like the British, and that Palestinian blood remains on British hands.
The UK has obligations under international humanitarian law and the Geneva Convention to look after the people who are occupied rather than stand with the oppressor, with the world's 21st century apartheid state. They must stop. They must support the Palestinians in real terms, not through words, two-state solution, which means absolutely nothing, but in sanctioning Israel, because that's the next thing that needs to happen.
Your policy on the Palestinians has to change. Justice has to prevail. And the way the hypocrisy, the way they do deal with the Palestinian issue and other issues like the Ukrainian issues, for example, is at least we can say a hypocritical way of dealing with it. Therefore, we are here today to raise our voice and tell them that this is not acceptable.
Though a ceasefire is supposed to be in force, commentators point out that this simply means Israel has moved its campaign of aggression to other parts of occupied Palestine, including Nablus, where there have already been casualties, raising the specter of an escalation resulting in further Palestinian blood being shed. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi-led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover-up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims bear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shootings against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
We never cease to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Why are the world rights entities keeping mum while Israel continues to kill innocent people in Gaza?
Tensions have escalated between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Friday, when Israel carried out airstrikes on cities across the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of people, including two commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. The Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, responded by firing hundreds of rockets towards Israel, putting the Israeli forces on the back foot. Activists here say the Islamic Jihad's show of force has pushed Tel Aviv into calling for a ceasefire, which took effect on Sunday.
In the past, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians would go unanswered. But today, as soon as Israel carries out a strike, the resistance responds immediately with its rockets. So, the era of hit and run is over.
The conflict is the worst outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Operation Sword Al-Quds, an 11-day war last May. The UN Security Council has expressed deep concern over the situation in the Gaza Strip during an emergency meeting held on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli aggression on the besieged territory.
While the UN has expressed its concern over the escalating violence against Palestinians, activists here say this is not enough. They called on the international body to stop paying lip service and take action to keep Israel from further violation of security in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis from all walks of life flocked to the street of Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the third Imam of Shia Muslims, Imam Hussein. He was martyred on Ashura, the 10th day of the lunar month of Muharram.
We went out as Yemenis to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who inspired patience and steadfastness in us in the face of the forces of global arrogance. We are in a battle with thousands of people like Yazid and even worse than him, including America and Israel. They attacked the Yemenis people and the Palestinian people. They are still killing our women and children. So this memory gives us hope that the values we learned from Imam Hussein will make us live generously and win at the end of the battle.
Imam Hussein, protesters said, is still alive because of his immortalized values and beliefs, which reject the oppression and corruption that Yemenis are currently experiencing. They further said Imam Hussein was the symbol of revolution and tenacity, who motivated Yemenis to resist the Saudi-led attack on their country.
This day is very important to us as we consider Ashura part of our identity. We are with Imam Hussein with our souls. Ashura this year coincides with the battle with the Zionist enemy, so the nation will follow the path of Imam Hussein in his jihad until the liberation of all occupied lands, especially occupied Al-Quds, and Yemen has come a long way towards freedom and independence.
After refusing to pledge alliance to the tyrant of the day, Yazid, in 680 AD, Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions and family members were killed during the Battle of Karbala.
People, he believed that Yemen has become a modern-day Karbala, with the Saudi-led coalition killing people, displacing civilians, and enforcing a siege on the country. People, he are confident that Yemen's fight against the enemy will ultimately lead to victory. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana.
Like every other Muslim nation in the world, Afghans mark the 10-day mourning ceremonies for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions. Tasua, which falls on the 9th of Muharram and is devoted to Imam Hussein's half-brother, Abu Fazl al-Abbas, drew hundreds of mourners to one of Kabul's old shrines. Attendees listened to clerics' speeches regarding the Battle of Karbala and beat on their chests.
This year, we are marking Muharram rituals under the rule of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. However, our processions are more crowded, passionate, and prosperous than previous ones. You know that Muharram is not only related to Shias, so we have our Sunni brothers taking part in ceremonies and services shoulder to shoulder with Shias.
We Afghan girls share the grief of Karbala tragedies with Zainab, Imam Ali's daughter. We are all sorrowful on this day and remember the suffering and bravery of our role model, Hazrat Zainab. Today, we live under the flag and our hijab shows that we are her firm followers.
On Ashura, Afghan Muslims shut their businesses and take a day off to pay tribute to Karbala martyrs. They say prayers and hold charity events. This year, despite security threats, they took part in mass mourning ceremonies alongside Taliban officials.
Today is the martyrdom anniversary of great and respected Islamic figure and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. I offer my condolences to you and all Muslims. Undoubtedly, Imam Hussein sacrificed his life to save Islam. We, the people of Afghanistan, followed Imam Hussein's path through fighting against invasion, arrogance, and oppression. May Allah keep the love of Imam Hussein alive in the hearts of all of us.
Ashura is significantly important in Islamic calendar. Ashura and Imam Hussein's school of thought teach us freedom, bravery, resistance, and Islamic unity. This righteous path will last until doomsday. We Muslims globally are obliged to announce and spread the message of Ashura to all Muslim and non-Muslim people, especially youths.
The commemoration comes as Shia Afghans have been repeatedly targeted in places of worship and schools by terrorist groups, only because of their ethnicity and beliefs. On the 7th and 8th of Muharram this year, two bomb explosions killed and injured more than 30 Shia mourners. Afghanistan has witnessed different social and political changes over the course of centuries. Against the odds, Shia Muslims have been steadfast in remembering the Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein's martyrdom. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of mourners marched through various streets wearing black and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein, who, along with dozens of his household members and loyal companions, were martyred in Karbala in present-day Iraq.
The marchers here said this is a time for sorrow and self-reflection when one commits himself completely to the mourning. They said the mourning and the reflection of the tragic events at Karbala are intended to connect to the suffering and martyrdom of Imam Hussein.
This very day, March 10th of Muharram, is the day of sadness, is the day of agony, is the day of shedding tears to all Muslims. And the reason is that in the field of Karbala, Imam Hussein was being mercilessly killed by Umayyad leaders.
The mourners also engaged in chest beating as the procession moved around the town in the hot tropical sun. The mourners said Ashura not only signifies intense grief for Imam Hussein, but is also a motivation for resistance against injustice in the world.
Imam Husseini has submitted his life entirely in order to save Islam. And that is what Malik Ibrahim Zakzaki Hafizahullah is calling for, that the entire Muslim and even non-Muslim, even Christian, let us gather together to fight oppressors, let humanity and then justice be in our nation.
Many of the mourners said they will continue this struggle to resist injustice because, as the well-known phrase goes, every day is Ashura and every land is Karbala. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Throngs of Londoners marching through the center of the British capital to commemorate Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, brutally murdered in the Battle of Karbala 1,400 years ago. Similar processions in the rest of the UK and the world to mourn him and his 72 companions killed along with him, among them members of his family. Their crime, standing up to the tyrant of the time, the Caliph Yazid.
It was a tragic incident that happened many years ago, but the moral stand that Imam Hussein took has transcended time and space. Its reverberations felt through generations, and this is proof of it.
Many generations later, men, women, and children flagellate themselves to identify with the suffering of the Prophet's grandson, a man of morals who strived for social justice.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam represents all of the martyrs in all the world throughout human history and planetary geography.
For me, he represents justice, bravery, and sacrifice.
His story is an example to mankind, as he stood against oppression and injustices.
And it's not just the mourning that unites the people here. For them, the march is an annual chance to share the legacy of Imam Hussein beyond the borders of their countries of origin. Saeed Purza, London.
Mourners in Karachi commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein's youngest child, who was not spared by the enemy forces.
The 6-month-old Ali Asghar, the youngest son of Imam Hussein, was martyred by the forces of Yazid. The Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein's sacrifices for righteousness and freedom are still a source of inspiration for Muslims around the world.
Mothers who brought their babies along paid tribute to Ali Asghar on the first Friday of the Islamic month of Muharram and mourned the 6-month-old son of Imam Hussein.
What had the 6-month-old done? We are out on the streets recalling the message of that innocent child of Imam Hussein, that we will always stand against the tyrant of the time. We will always stand shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed, no matter what.
Special eulogies and rituals were performed to commemorate the incident where Ali Asghar was killed with an arrow shot in his throat in the plains of the Iraqi city of Karbala.
We are commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Ali Asghar, the youngest martyr of Karbala, who teaches us the lessons of readiness and sacrifice in the face of injustice and brutality.
Ali Asghar was martyred while he was in the arms of his father Imam Hussein, who was pleading for water to quench the thirst of his little baby. The grandson of Prophet Muhammad and his companions sacrificed their lives but refused to pledge allegiance to the unjust Umayyad Caliph Yazid. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Israeli regime has attacked Gaza again, and it is time Canadians understood their country's contribution to the brutal treatment of those living in the 360 square kilometer strip of land, says Yves Engler, journalist, in an article published under the heading "Condemn latest Israeli regime attack on Gaza and Canadian complicity." Stay tuned for more. The Israeli regime has attacked Gaza again, and it is time Canadians understood their country's contribution to the brutal treatment of those living in the 360 square kilometer strip of land. On August 5th, the Zionist regime killed at least 10, including a 5-year-old girl, in Gaza. 75 more Palestinians were injured in the latest outburst of Israeli violence. Most of those living in Gaza were driven from their homes in 1947 to 48. Canada played a central role in drafting and promoting the 1947 UN Partition Plan, which legitimized the Zionist movement's ethnic cleansing. Before that, Royal Military College of Canada graduate Charles McPherson Double commanded Britain's 1917 Second Battle of Gaza, and hundreds of Canadians fought in the General Allenby-led Third Battle of Gaza. They employed significant amounts of chemical weapons. Canada armed the Zionist regime in the years after it ethnically cleansed 750,000 Palestinians. The weapons deliveries continued even after the IDF launched a number of murderous raids into Gaza and Egypt that left dozens dead in 1954 and 1955. After the Israeli regime invaded Egypt with the British and French in 1956, Foreign Affairs Minister Lester Pearson wanted to take Gaza away from Egyptian administration and make it UN-controlled. This proposal was rejected by the Arab countries because it would have made it more difficult to expose Israeli regime aggression on Palestine. Syria's spokesperson at the UN complained that the representative of Canada is deftly supporting the Zionist policy. Between 1967 and 2005, the fake regime of Israel formally occupied Gaza. Soon after withdrawing, the Israeli regime imposed a blockade which has restricted food and medicine entering the tiny coastal territory. Today, 2 million Palestinians live in a giant prison cut off from the world by the Israeli regime military. Canada has enabled the fake regime of Israel's siege of Gaza. After Hamas won legislative elections in 2006, Canada was the first country to impose sanctions against the Palestinians. Ottawa's aid cutoff and refusal to recognize a Palestinian unity government was designed to sow division within Palestinian society. It helped spare fighting between the factions. When Hamas took control of Gaza, the fake regime of Israel used that to justify its siege of the coastal territory. Canada has refused to criticize the Israeli regime's brutal blockade. For example, Canada was the only country at the UN Human Rights Council to vote against a January 2008 resolution that called for urgent international action to put an immediate end to the siege of the occupied Gaza Strip. The motion was adopted with 30 votes in favor and 15 abstentions. In November 2011, the Canadian boat to Gaza set sail to challenge Israeli regime's illegal blockade. The Israeli regime navy captured the Canadian flagged boat in international waters, a violation of international law, with no protest from Ottawa. Instead, Foreign Affairs criticized the political humanitarian mission and the Canadians imprisoned, tasered, and robbed by Israelis. In 2009, Ottawa barred British parliamentarian George Galloway from Canada for delivering humanitarian aid to Gaza officials who were the elected administration in this territory. Similarly, the International Relief Fund for the Afflicted and Needy lost its charitable status and was the first ever Canadian-based group designated a terrorist organization for engaging in the ghastly act of supporting orphans and a hospital in Gaza through official channels. The Toronto-based organization tried to send a dialysis machine to Gaza and continued to support orphans in the impoverished territory with the money channeled through the post office controlled by the telecommunications ministry. Canada also legitimized the Zionist regime siege of Gaza by directly participating in it. In 2009, Canada joined the Gaza Counter-Arms Smuggling Initiative alongside the Netherlands, France, Germany, Norway, Denmark, Italy, and the US. We look forward to continuing to work with our partners on the program of action to coordinate efforts to stop the flows of arms, ammunition, and related material into the Gaza Strip, then Foreign Affairs Minister Lawrence Cannon said in a statement. As it has locked up Gaza's population, the fake regime of Israel has launched a series of deadly wars in 2009, 2014, 2021, etc. In 2018 to 19, 200 Palestinians were killed and another 5,000 injured by live fire in peaceful march of return protests in Gaza. About 5,000 Palestinians have been martyred by the fake regime of Israel in Gaza during the past 15 years. Ottawa has generally ignored or justified the Zionist regime's killing. The Trudeau government has so far failed to condemn the Israeli regime's latest outbursts of violence. Canadians of conscience must, at minimum, condemn the Israeli regime's violence against the long-besieged Palestinians in Gaza and call on the government to do the same.
Spotlight. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The stark warning from the Bank of England on the UK's economy. Not only will the UK economy face a contraction, we'll enter a year-long recession. This has forced the bank to raise interest rates to record high, which has not been done in 27 years. How will the Brits deal with this, which includes a high cost of living? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what the UK government can do to deal with this economic challenge. This is while there's really no government in place in order to tackle this head-on. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight first. Historian and journalist Tony Goslin joins us from Bristol. Also joining us, economist and author Steve Keen, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Steve Keen, let me first start with you and get an idea about this warning from the Bank of England. It's not obviously, it's pretty bad in its content. A recession to last until next year, which you can tell us the definition would be five consecutive quarters of a contraction, each quarter to be 3 months in duration. Tell us more about that and how the Bank of England can be so sure into the future that the UK is going to be experiencing this inflation or recession.
They can be fairly sure about the inflation as for the level of contraction. Did you say five quarters then?
Is it
five quarters of negative growth?
Is that okay. Isn't that what it is until next year?
That's the length of time. The usual, like the informal definition of a recession is two consecutive negative quarters. To get five is a serious recession. So I think it's quite feasible that these sorts of falls are going to occur because we've had two major forces that kept the economy ticking during COVID. One was enormous government deficits, which generate an identical private sector surplus, giving people money to spend, which they did, which is why the recession was so short-lived. Now the government's talking about trying to balance its books, which is a stupid thing for the government to be focusing upon, but if they do reduce their size of the deficit, they also reduce the amount of money they're injecting into private bank accounts. People have less money and there's a downturn there. And then with higher interest rates, which are now passing through to mortgages, credit cards, and so on, that higher cost of money is going to discourage people from taking out credit. So rather than credit going very strongly, as it did also during the COVID boom, we could now see credit turning negative. And that's what caused the Great Recession or the global financial crisis back in 2008. So we're going to get potentially a double whammy of a government-induced recession from high rates and from cutting back on its spending on top of a private sector, one caused by a reduction in credit.
Okay. What we are also seeing here, Tony Gosling, not to get too, I guess, technical in a sense, is that we're seeing how the household incomes are not keeping up, in a sense, with the inflation. So they don't have that purchasing power. And that is going to obviously have a dent not only on the economy, but also just in terms of the quality of life that people are going to be experiencing based on what we are looking at. And, you know, inflation to, well, it's, the Bank of England says it's going to peak at 13.5%. But people are having a really hard time as we speak. Tell us how this is going to pan out when it comes to just people's lives in terms of what is being now announced by the Bank of England.
Well, look, Steve Keen has just explained what's going on very, very in a very, very concise fashion there. I think what we need to understand, though, is that something really big is going on. It reminds me very much of the West's reaction, the NATO countries' reaction to the Russians going into Ukraine. Is the actual solution to this, the Bank of England increasing interest rates, seems to be almost designed to make the problem worse. There's something very perverse seems to be happening. I think we're basically at war, is an economic war taking place, and that war is between traditional, sane, sensible forms of industrial capitalism, where the government acts as a kind of mediator and the central banks act as mediators in order to ensure that there's no ability for private interests to profiteer and to get into infrastructure, where basically they just sit back and reel in as much money and start price fixing as much as they want. And this new form, well, it's newer form of capitalism, which is finance capitalism, which basically means money is your god. And you can do anything with that money. If you can bribe your way into a government office and take over a government service, you can do it. And that's the war which is going on in Britain at the moment. And it does seem as if the finance capitalists are winning here. But Steve and I are both, you will see neither of us on British television talking about this. This is, of course, what British people and policymakers need to hear. And so that's interesting in itself that we are completely shut out of that debate. I have to thank you at Press TV for even allowing this to take place, that the British people can then start to see. Anyway, beyond that, you asked me about what the British people are going to be doing over this. And I've been talking to rail workers today who are having a particularly hard time and having a little chat to them. It's quite obvious to me that what's going on is... Sorry, I've lost your connection completely. Sorry.
No problem. Well, while you fix that, let me come to you, Steve Keen. This fall in living standards is said to be the longest and deepest fall on record. And it's the way it was described, that one of the biggest reasons for that are the energy bills that are set to triple. Triple. I mean, that's a lot. How does that translate for households that can't afford to, for example, pay it? You know what I mean? What was going to happen?
Yeah. Well, there are people who already were very close to the red line in the UK. The low-income earners in the UK, I don't know how they survived, frankly. Given my own background, I was earning about £90,000 a year when I was in London, which it ended up being £4,000 a month, and half of that went in my accommodation, and the remainder had to go on living. And I found it challenging compared to the same income back in Australia, where I was quite comfortable. That I know first-year teachers, first-year nurses, first-year firemen, and so on, are on wages between £20,000 and £25,000 a year. Now, they can't even imagine living in London, and the costs for them in the rest of the country were already high. Trebling the cost of energy is going to mean for a lot of those people they will not be able to afford energy, and they will therefore have to consider things like wearing, gloves inside their own homes to avoid freezing during winter. And they certainly can't do anything to fight the increase in temperature when you get the enormous temperatures that are coming through courtesy of global warming now. London recording, England recording 40 degrees, which is literally unheard of in its historic record. So they're going to suffer very badly. And I think there's going to be an enormous amount of angst out of this and lots of strike action over it, but very little chance to change the direction of government policy and very little chance to increase their wages as well.
Well, why not? Why wouldn't the government change its policy?
The government has been following the wrong policy for 40 years. It's very unlikely to wake up, oh dear, we've been doing it wrongly, let's do it the right way now. They still think the government should be behaving like a household and trying to save money every year. Now, the government is not a household. No other household that I know of has the right to create money. that the government does. So if the government creates money, that money turns up in our bank accounts, and that requires the government to run a deficit. Now, the English government has been obsessed by running a surplus, looking at the accounting of the economy from just their point of view, and thinking if they pay a surplus, they can pay their debt down, and they see that as responsible. But because what happens with the government is the mirror image of what happens with the non-government, if the government runs a surplus of $1 trillion, the private sector runs a deficit of $1 trillion. We're not talking about numbers that high, but fundamentally it's a seesaw. One's up, the other's down. The average is zero. So if the government is trying to save money, it's causing the private sector to dissave. Now, they've been doing that nonetheless for 40 years. They still haven't woken up. I really have no confidence that they will ever wake up over this. So they're doing the wrong thing, and yet they think they're doing the right thing. Human's capacity to self-delude cannot be underestimated.
Uh-huh. So the lesson I'm learning from you here, and hopefully the viewers, is that the government shouldn't have a surplus, because that money should actually be flowing into the people, average people, to take out and spend into the economy. So having a surplus is not a great idea. Okay, so the cost of living crisis, Tony Gosling, this is what the Bank of England has said, that it's going to continue throughout next year and only begin to ease in the year 2024. And then, of course, along with that, the UK economy contracting for all this time. 2024 is 2022. The timeline there is so long. How are people going to survive?
No, I know, but you see, the thing is, these predictions by the Bank of England have a rather a nasty habit of in a couple of years' time, they say, well, sorry, we got that wrong. It's going to be continuing even beyond that, this recession. I mean, I think really what we're looking at here is a deliberate sabotaging of the economy. The thing is that there are people that benefit from this. You have to understand this is how finance capitalism works. What they do is they wreck countries and then they pick up the pieces for next to nothing. And that's what they're doing to Britain now. Many of these Anglo-Zionist Empire great financiers have been doing this around the world. They've been wrecking countries and then buying up for cheap. And also, of course, they make a lot of money on these reconstruction contracts. And one of the big effects of the enormous green taxes that have been being put onto fuel here in Britain is that it's driving small firms out of business. Many small firms in Bristol, we've been checking out the tax which is being put onto people. They say it's a clean air tax, but against their own figures, of 40 micrograms of nitrogen dioxide per square meter. This is the amount that they use to measure whether it's a dangerous level or not. The Bristol figures are actually below that level as an average through the year, which is what the government has said. And yet they're imposing this new toll, effectively. That's what it is anyway. The super rich don't pay the toll because they all have brand new cars, which don't pay the toll. And even disabled people have to pay these tolls. So what we're really looking at is an embattled criminal elite, I think. And their plans are failing around the world. Their economic plans are failing. And so they're turning on their own population and seeing them now as a kind of milch cow in order to squeeze them for as much wealth as out of them as they possibly can. And when they collapse these small businesses, this of course, plays into the hands of the giants like Amazon, who I noticed, by the way, today in Britain, we've had one of the first proper strikes at Amazon, where all of the Amazon workers who were offered 35 pence pay increases, you know, tiny amounts of money by the company, have just downed tools. And at one point, actually, they were locked up illegally within the workplace and they couldn't leave. So this is what we're dealing with. I think a fascistic system where, and I use that word advisedly, because this is fascism. When big corporations think they can rule the roost, do what they want without any kind of recourse to government or law, they just see then the legal actions against them as a cost of doing business. And so they just do what they want. And that's what I think we're seeing. These big companies now think, well, the more small businesses we can ruin and destroy, the bigger our control of the markets will be. And that's, you're quite right to point out at the beginning that we're in this kind of interregnum here in Britain where Boris has gone. We've got probably a couple of people possibly taking over, most likely Liz Truss, who is a total puppet. So there is no real government. You're quite right. And the big corporations love it like that. The big oil companies, the energy companies have just brought in record profits more than ever before. They are basically running the show here, and the people are cannon fodder to them.
Okay, well, let's look at the reasons that have been cited, first of all, how this has been described, Steve Keen. High inflation, low growth, soaring energy bills, and it's been described as the main driver behind that overall is the Ukraine conflict. Now, do you agree that this is just because of the Ukraine conflict? I mean, was UK's economy doing well before the Ukraine conflict, or were there remnants prior to that?
There are basically three major factors that are coming together all at once. One is that we have pushed, we've ignored the warning of the limits to growth 50 years ago and continued pushing our energy consumption. So now we're consuming probably four times as much as we were back in 1972. And that means we've exhausted cheap oil. We're now exhausting even unconventional oil. So the cost of energy is rising, and that's inevitably going to continue happening. We, at the same time, we have had a period of extended low inflation courtesy of globalization. So particularly American corporations, but also UK corporations, have outsourced manufacturing to China, which reduced costs dramatically for a long, long time, but also made the manufacturing sector very fragile because there's an enormous supply chain. And if that gets disrupted at any point, then costs rise. And of course, COVID has dramatically disrupted the supply chain, particularly from China. Then we have this period of ongoing austerity by governments where they falsely believe they should save money, but rather than saving money, what they're doing is creating not enough money, and therefore the economy grows more slowly because of a lack of government of money for turnover. So those three factors are all coming together at once, and the most important one, I think, for the long term is a rising cost of production. And in that situation, if you want to squeeze inflation out of the economy, there's only two other factors you can affect. You can reduce wages, which were already at trivial levels in the UK, or you can reduce the markups that firms put on their input costs. And that is something which the firms have resisted for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Now, the interest rates are likely to increase the cost of business, not reduce it. So I think the government is finding out how impotent it is now with the tools it's chosen to use.
The 2008 financial crisis, obviously, Tony Gosling, had a very deep effect and impact not only across the world but also on the UK. Now, this one, which has been described as a recession that's going to last, it's the longest downturn since the 2008 financial crisis. And the way that one analyst has described it is that it's going to be as deep. It's not set to be as deep as 14 years ago, but it's going to last just as long. My question is, do you agree? And do you think that, according to some, that the UK actually did it claw itself out of the 2008 financial crisis all the way, or is it still experiencing it?
Well, look, I'm sure Steve will agree that the reaction to the 2008 bailouts, I mean, this was really where massive amounts of public money went to save zombie banks, and they shouldn't really have done. They should have just simply been allowed to collapse. But what happened there was the end of capitalism. It was the death of capitalism, because what happened, what they did is they resurrected these banks that should have just been allowed to collapse. And what that's done is it's now compounding the problem. Again and again, what we're seeing is governments. In fact, there was an enormous bailout during the COVID crisis, as people may know, just before the COVID crisis in 2019, which the COVID crisis was quite successfully hid. And so we're not getting the proper figures about how much public money is going into propping up these dead and dying banks. And that's, I think, what's going on. And actually on the ground here, what we've got, of course, is we've got people's living standards being eroded in all sorts of ways, particularly through these rising energy prices, which I'm not sure, as Steve suggested there, is just part of a market force that's going on. There are enormous green taxes now coming in. We've got something in Britain called the RTFO, which went up 20 pence a litre on diesel and petrol over Christmas. But the fuel companies actually covered that up by dropping their price the same day by an equivalent amount. So there's a sneaky bringing in of these so-called green taxes into fuel. And one of the things that Boris did before he went back in 2021 was actually to refuse this new increase, these green taxes, in the cabinet, saying that, well, hang on, because this is going to cause inflation. Well, of course, it has caused inflation. But the thing is, they did it anyway. They basically ignored the what was the discussion in cabinet, and parts of the government, the Department for Transport, the Treasury, colluded with the big oil companies to bring the taxes in anyhow. So there are all sorts of reasons for this, but the main problem is that people's living standards are being eroded. That's why we're seeing industrial action on the railways, which is the biggest union in the country, who actually represent the left in Britain. They represent the political opposition to the Tory party, really, because the Labour Party is simply doing absolutely nothing about all this. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. That is to say, people simply saying, getting organised and simply saying, well, we refuse to work if you're going to be, destroying our jobs and also eroding our ability to pay. But look, the long and short of this is, in a nutshell, is this is the Great Reset. I believe that is exactly what's going on here. This is what was talked about in 2020 and 21 by the World Economic Forum. What they really want to do is to collapse the economy and replace it with their own version. So this is what's called disaster capitalism. This is what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism. But they're doing it on their own people now. They've been doing it around the world for years. Now they've turned on their own kind.
That was discussed at the WEF. Do you agree with this, Steve Keane, that this is the Great Reset?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I've met quite a few of the people that are supposed to be running this conspiracy, and they couldn't plan lunch. Okay? The extent to which people think a conspiracy is causing all this, yes, of course, these people are conspiring. Yes, of course, they're trying to get outcomes that suit themselves. Do they understand the system they're managing? Not in the slightest. So they end up causing catastrophes, and what you get is a disaster to another, and they try to maneuver their way through. They've got more power, of course, than a worker or a member of a trade union has, so they can come out on top as a result of it. But to put this down as a result of some sort of plan, as I said, they couldn't plan lunch. So I think it's ridiculous to blame it on a conspiracy, but to correct it, blame on people being in charge of a system they don't understand, and it's being hit by forces they have ignored for 50 years, the limits of growth in particular, the wrong way to run monetary policy, bring it all together. I could use lots of very colourful terms here to describe what's going on, but none of them involve a power elite knowing what they're doing.
Well, we need to find out, not we, the UK and the incoming administration, whoever's going to be the PM, needs to figure out what to do. Is there a game plan? Tony Gosling, 30 seconds.
Well, what they need to do, I think, is to bring most of the infrastructure of the country, including the railways, etc., into public ownership. And they can do that very easily, very cheaply, by just simply not renewing franchises. This is happening naturally anyway. For example, on the railways, we've had several of the companies that have been running regional railways collapse anyway, and the government's had to take them in hand themselves. But those organisations, including, by the way, I think, finance needs to be seen as a public utility, as it is in China and Russia and places like that, where the core of the financial system is managed by the government. That's why we elect them, in order to run the country.
Okay.
The worst thing in the world is when all these private businesses take these over. This was started by Thatcher, of course. We need to renationalise these things.
Very well. Thank you for that, Tony Gosling from Bristol, historian and journalist. Steve Keane from London.